calendar this morning is docket number 65856, Manning v. State. Counsel, are we ready?
We are.
Okay, come on up.
Good morning. William Waters on behalf of Mr. Manning from the Clark County Public Defender's Office. With me at counsel table is Marissa Pensabeni, who was the trial attorney in this case. Can I get 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Certainly. Please?
Thank you. So this court's order directing full briefing made this, I guess, pretty easy because there's really, you know, one issue here, although, and the one issue based on the order is, you know, whether the court should reconsider Lisby, and if so, to what extent. And admittedly, there's pretty compelling reasons on both sides for either keeping it or abrogating it. And I would like to point out again, though, it is our contention that Ms. Pensabeni did ask for a lesser-included offense instruction pursuant to her theory of defense, and that there were independent reasons why it should have been given apart from sort of the judge's sua sponte duty, and that the court erred by not giving it under those circumstances. But returning to the issue of whether Lisby should be abrogated, I guess the question really comes down to, and I'm going to be candid with you, I don't think I've got all the answers, but I think the question really comes down to, how do we view a criminal trial? Is there some overriding principle about justice and so forth, and that the public has a stake in this, or is it strictly a contest between two parties playing sort of a high-stakes game of chess, and you know, who can outmaneuver the other person? I think that Lisby's recognition that the judge, who statutorily is required to instruct the jury on all aspects of the law, does so sua sponte when there's evidentiary support, I think is an acknowledgement that maybe a trial isn't just merely a contest between two combatants.
And Mr. Waters, can I ask you a question on that? Because this troubles me. You haven't done a lot of trials like many of my colleagues have. Isn't it up to the attorneys to specifically ask for the lesser instruction? Because I know I've seen trials, maybe murder cases, where the defense does not want a lesser included. They want it all or nothing. I mean, they want to put the state to their burden of proving malice, the premeditated malice, and they don't want a manslaughter instruction. So how can a judge sua sponte give instructions that the defense may not want, even though the judge may think the lesser included instruction might be warranted based on the facts of the case?
That's a great question. That sort of highlights some of the problems. But I do think that you do find support in other areas of law where the judge is an active participant in the trial and not merely a passive participant letting the parties sort of decide what they want to do. I mean, they're out there. The judge has sua sponte obligations in certain respects. For example, with I think I mentioned in my brief with the Tavares instruction and so forth. And again, I think it comes down to it's a great question, Your Honor, and I think that it's worth debating. But I do think it goes back to, you know, how do we view a criminal trial? You're right. Like, it could very well be a defendant's strategy to say, hey, look, I've done something wrong, but guess what? They make the charging decision. They chose to charge it incorrectly. And, you know, I get to live or die with that decision. If you're not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt, then I get to walk.
But in this case, you're saying counsel asked for the instruction and the judge refused to give the lesser included.
Correct.
So it's completely different than what Justice Gibbons was asking about as to sua sponte. This is not a sua sponte issue. This is an issue that the trial court either erred or they didn't err by not giving the lesser included, period.
Well,
let's make it easy for ourselves.
Well, exactly. And you know, maybe that's sort of the point here. Maybe we should be debating whether there was Justice Pickering pointed out, maybe we should be debating whether there was a proper request. But the thing is, Lisby said there's numerous situations where a jury instruction has to be given. And only one of them was sua sponte. And then Lisby set out the evidentiary standard for the judge to have to intervene sua sponte. And that would be when there's evidence which completely absolves the defendant of guilt for the greater offense and supports guilt for the lesser offense. Then Lisby talked about some other circumstances which Rosas then abrogated, but then finally came to the idea of, like, well, if there's any evidence at all upon a reasonable theory of defense that would support the lesser included offense, then you've got to give it if it's requested. And I think that that's important. So,
could I interrupt you?
Sure.
One of the things that caught my eye about this entire discussion, and I really appreciate the briefs, they were excellent on both sides, and the court directed this, but Lisby, it's pure dictum, because in that case, we affirmed the judgment of conviction, correct?
Yeah, I think so, yes.
Is there any Nevada case that has held and reversed on the basis of that holding that the failure sua sponte to give a lesser included instruction was reversible error? Is there any case that has so held as the actual outcome in the case rather than statements philosophically?
You know, I think both the state and myself did a pretty exhaustive search of cases in Nevada because their position was that Lisby has never applied. You know, my position is,
right, but
to answer your question, I didn't find them.
I didn't either. And in the nose count of other states, what other states have done and what categories they fall into, I was intrigued by how many of them may have statements of the ones that are so-called trial integrity states. How many of those states actually, it was the holding and it was an actual reversal based on a failure sua sponte to instruct on the lesser included? I couldn't tell whether, and if so, how many states. It looks like maybe 4 or 5, even of the 8 to 10 that have been identified as trial integrity states. Nevada's identified as one, but are there actual cases that reverse on that basis?
Well, I mean, I'll be honest with you. It was a pretty daunting project researching all 50 states, all the federal circuits, Guam, Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands. And I wish I had more time, and I would have like more thoroughly delved into that. I don't know the answer to that question, like whether Massachusetts, which I believe is trial integrity, has whether there's cases out there where they reversed on the judge's failure to do it. I do know, because I was at Boston College as an undergrad during the Louise Woodward trial, where this idea was like came up, and it was all over the news, and this idea that the judge, sua sponte, changed it because Louise Woodward was convicted of first-degree murder in a shaken baby allegation. And it was big news in Boston at the time, late 90s, or the mid-90s, rather. And the judge on his own then, sua sponte, said, no, I'm going to change the verdict to manslaughter. So it kind of, that wasn't an appellate court decision, but I think it did withstand appellate scrutiny, if I'm not mistaken, because the state did appeal that to the Massachusetts Supreme Court. But so, I mean, there are
examples. That's the same issue presenting procedurally differently.
Procedurally different, correct.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I don't want to derail your argument on the philosophical point, but I also want to hear about the preserved error. Is there any place in the record other than pages, volume 3, 558-59, that the request was made for a lesser included, or is that what we have?
That's what we have. The Judge Hernan chose to have the jury instruction discussion in chambers, which he's allowed to do. I believe 165-161 says you can do that. And I think what happened was, you know, there was probably more discussion in chambers, which unfortunately isn't part of the record. And then when they come back, you know, most things are settled, and they're just sort of dealing with, like, this defense had 4 specials that were not given.
But we don't have a tender of a lesser included, which I understand may not be the case always in a criminal case that you actually have the tendered draft instruction.
Right, but we don't have that. You're correct. You're correct, okay. Your Honor. I do think, though, that in the context of the way this played out, I think that Ms. Pensavini's request makes sense that it applied to the, I mean, she said the word robbery, but I don't think that she never said battery is a lesser included offense of robbery. She did not say that. And I think that if she was trying to justify that, she would have said why she believed that. I think what she was saying was summarizing a more in-depth conversation in chambers, which you can infer because even Judge Herndon was like, well, you know, there's this idea about merger and so forth. So you can kind of see that maybe in chambers there was a philosophical.
There had been a Jackson-Salazar discussion and a lesser included, and it got imperfectly.
And then in the court's desire to sort of finish the trial, okay, we've decided on the jury instructions. I've made my ruling. Let's just really quickly here put these on the record as to the ones that you weren't given and so forth. And I think Ms. Pensavini, because remember the state charged him with battery with the intent to commit robbery, but there was, I don't believe, after reading the entire transcript, that the state ever said, you know, well, if you don't think he actually robbed the guy, then we've got this other. I think the state proceeded in this trial always arguing this was a robbery. We've got 2 witnesses.
And the jury acquitted him of robbery. So if you're going to have error in not giving the instruction sua sponte, you would have prejudice here, arguably, because of the jury found no robbery.
Right. And
I see.
That's how Lisby sort of came up here. I'll be honest with you. When I'm writing the appeal, I'm writing it as this was a theory of defense jury instruction that she requested, which wasn't given by the court. It's reversible error. Anticipating that the state might say, well, you know, she said the word robbery, so I'm not quite sure about that. I think as a good appellate attorney, you have to get a little proactive. So I threw Lisby in there as a, oh, and by the way, you know, there was evidence through his testimony that completely absolved him of guilt for the robbery, because he did say, I never robbed the man. I did bump into him as I was, sort of, he was in the way as I'm getting off the bus and I knocked him down. I feel bad about it. You know, I didn't realize he was so frail. So I pointed that out just as, sort of to head off what I anticipated was going to be the state's argument that, well, this wasn't really a proper request. And I think I would be derelict in my responsibilities as his appellate attorney if I didn't mention that. Because Lisby is currently, as we sit here right now, it is the law in Nevada, and it's controlling. And as recently as 2006, and I understand that it was in a footnote in Rosas.
But I go ahead.
Simple question. You're here. This is your appeal. What do you want this court to do? Because we've gone all over the place, and I'm trying to figure out where the center is. So what do you want? What relief do you want for your client?
Well, are you asking my personal opinion?
You're the attorney standing in front of me.
Well, I think it certainly behooves Mr. Manning to have this court reaffirm the significance of Lisby. I think that, without question, I think even this court's order sort of acknowledges that, because you asked us to assume that a sua sponte instruction would have been required in this case. So I think, yes, I think that if Lisby is reaffirmed, then Mr. Manning wins, and my obligation is to Mr. Manning, so I would suggest that...
I hear that from you right now, but about 30 seconds ago, that's not the argument you were making. That's why I'm trying to clarify.
Well,
because whether or not we're looking at a situation where we play games of first counsel says, I'm not going to ask for this, but second counsel comes in, well, that's an effective assistance counsel. He didn't ask for this. So what are we doing? What do you want?
Well, I would like Mr. Manning's conviction to be reversed. I think I've asserted at least two grounds that, yes, are somewhat inconsistent, but I think that either one gets him relief at this particular point.
So if we affirm them, are we looking at ineffective assistance of counsel in a couple of years?
Well, not under Lisby.
Are you trying to save your colleague by saying this is a Lisby issue and not whether she asked for or did not ask for a lesser included? I mean, let's get right to the point.
I don't think, if I have to project that, I don't think IAC would be successful because she didn't ask. Now, whether she asked for it properly or not, I mean, my understanding of IAC is more, you know, as long as you can, like, point to some strategic decision for doing something, whether it's perfectly articulated or not.
Well, how can she can't point to a strategy here because she's saying she asked for it. And I guess she's going to say the counsel for the state's going to say she didn't ask for it. So it's one of the other. I think Lisby is a red herring in this. I'm not ready to talk about Lisby. I want to talk about whether she asked for it or she did. And how could she let things happen in chambers that weren't put on the record in the district court in front of Judge Harding? Those are the questions I have.
I agree. And it's interesting because I actually said to the state's representative this morning that I really think that's more of the issue in this case. But this court did direct full briefing on Lisby. So, you know, I'm trying to comply with this court's order by discussing Lisby. But, yes, Your Honor.
Well, doesn't it become more important then as to whether or not there was an ask for a particular instruction? And, you know, once you get into sua sponte instructions, I get a little bit, it's just as Gibbons indicated, I get a little bit uncomfortable there because it becomes strategic. And you had said Lisby was an, oh, by the way, this was more a theory of defense case in which I think it makes it more important is to have a clear picture as whether or not the instruction was requested.
Well, I said Lisby was an, oh, by the way, because as an appellate attorney, you're looking, and I think, you know, if you read the performance standards promulgated by this court, like, I have an obligation to review every conceivable way to get him relief on appeal, and this was one of them.
Yeah.
So I did include it.
Would battery, legally, would battery with intent to commit robbery actually be a true lesser included of robbery? Because you could have robbery without the battery component. So, I mean, reading her request for the instruction, if you're saying this is a lesser included, I was trying to understand how it truly could be a lesser included under a pristine.
Well, you're right. I don't think it's a truly lesser included of robbery, because you're right. You can have an assault as the force part of a robbery and not necessarily a battery.
A gun.
So, right. So under this court's precedent, I don't think it would be a true lesser included offense of robbery. I would point out, though, as well, that the state did not object below, and they did not even say anything below with respect to her request. They didn't say, Judge, that's an improper request. They didn't say battery is not a lesser included of robbery.
And when she said we asked for a lesser included in this case, clearly referencing Chambers conference,
right.
My question reading that was, how could battery with intent to, I'm sorry to eat your time, how could battery with intent to commit robbery be a true lesser included of robbery, and why would we not credit this request as sufficient for the plain battery as a lesser included of battery with intent to commit robbery?
Well, right. That's what I think. If I understand your question correctly, I think that's what I'm saying.
Like, yeah.
It seems to me, yes, reasonable minds can differ about the request, but I think if you, and going back to, I believe it was Justice Cherry's question, why wasn't this more fully developed on the record? You know, okay, best practices might be to make
a tendered instruction.
Okay, agreed. Absolutely. And maybe make a better record once you're out there. But I do think that the statute allows judges to hold jury instruction conferences in chambers. And that was Judge Herndon's prerogative. That's the way he chose to do it. And I don't think it behooves any criminal defendant or his attorney to say, I refuse to do that. If you're asking me, no, I'd rather have it on the record. Now, you know, maybe some criminal defense attorneys would do it. I'd probably do it, but, you know, I'm not very agreeable on those things. But then when you come out and everything's settled, I think there's a tendency to sort of, let's move this along, let's get this to the jury. I mean, obviously, I mean, as Justice Gibbons mentioned earlier, most people up here were district court judges. There is a concern that we don't want to waste too much of the jury's time because they're doing their public service and they have lives to get back to.
But the real question is, did the judge afford an opportunity to make a record of what was proposed or what was asked?
He did. He did, absolutely. I don't think the cold record necessarily would convey whether that opportunity was, you know, where there was a sense of urgency or not. And
because Mr. Waters, quite candidly, in most courtrooms, they settled the instructions in chambers. They come out and allow counsel to make whatever record they wish to make.
Right.
And they don't move it along as you're portraying. They give them an opportunity. Whether counsel takes advantage of that or not, that's counsel's choice.
Well, I do think that there is, you know, precedent from this court where the courts have. I mean, I think there was a case recently where one district court judge said, I'm not going to stay here till 5 o'clock and pay for a sitter. So, I mean, there is instances where
Mr. Waters, that case really doesn't apply to the facts that we're talking about. I'm aware of that.
Understood.
Wasn't the strategy here for this counsel, for this defense attorney, to have the client found not guilty of robbery and to have the lesser included on misdemeanor battery so that the conviction would be a misdemeanor rather than a felony? Isn't that the strategy?
I 100% believe that.
And if that had been put on the record, this would have been a easy case for me.
Absolutely.
Now the question is there enough on the record for me to be able to write on that?
I think that there is, Your Honor. And I would point out that there are other cases, Crawford, for example, that says that when you submit a theory of defense jury instruction that is inartfully worded or not complete, this court has said that the district court then has a sua sponte obligation to help you fix it. So if there was any question whatsoever about the legitimacy of her request, why wouldn't the district court judge say, okay, you're asking for a theory of defense jury instruction. Let's just make sure I'm clear about this, because if you're asking for it for robbery, you're not entitled to it. It's not a lesser. Now, if you're asking for it because it's a lesser of battery with the intent to commit robbery, you got it, and I'll go ahead and give it to you. But the problem was Judge Herndon went on some tangent about Salazar and merger, which is fine, and I appreciate his concern about whether this defendant should be convicted of two serious felony charges, but that really wasn't the germane argument at that point. It was merely why you're not entitled to it as a lesser-included offense. Now, we can debate, you know, what role the judge versus the attorney has at the trial, but I think at the very least we can agree that the judge at that point should make a ruling concerning her request.
But we don't know what the request was, and that's what bothers me. If you cut this to its simplest element,
It would be, and we encourage over and over that if there's an issue, you come back and you put it on the record. I requested this instruction. The judge did not give the instruction because of this, this, or this. And that's what bothers me in this case. I don't know what happened in the joint appendix. Doesn't make it clear.
And I'm well over my time, but if I could just respond.
And you know what? I'm going to give you, we've kind of grilled you, so I'm going to give you two additional minutes in rebuttal, and I'll give the state the same thing. But
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Now, just to respond to your question, I don't think it's unclear that what the request was here. The request was for a lesser-included offense instruction. Now, whether that request was for robbery or battery offense committing crime is debatable. The request was not like he can't be convicted of both of these charges because they merge or they're in jeopardy. And that's, I think, the problem here is that Judge Herndon's decision was based more on a double jeopardy Salazar merger Gravamen sort of argument versus you're asking for a lesser included offense. And that, I think, is clear. I don't think we can debate that she said lesser. So there's no dispute here what she was asking for. I guess the issue is, and what we can debate about, is the sufficiency of the request, although
but
I'm saying
she,
it was.
She did follow and say, we are of the belief, based on the testimony of Mr. Berg and Ms. Borley's testimony, it shows that the battery in this case is the force required in the robbery. So the first sentence says we want a lesser included. The second references those two people's testimony, and those people testified that there were items taken from the man's pocket. So...
Right, but and again, I think it goes back to since the state had always proceeded on a theory that this was an actual robbery and that he didn't like merely intend to commit a robbery and then somehow like not complete it, I think that the problem is you get when you're doing the trial, you're thinking like, you know, well, the state's alleging a robbery. There was testimony concerning a robbery.
I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying.
So she's using the word robbery to sort of say like, well, you know, there's...
Even as the battery with intent to commit, it wasn't
right. Clear. Right. Okay. That the force would naturally apply to that charge as well, because the state didn't charge it in the way that was. Well, on one theory, we think that there was a battery plus a taking, and then on another theory, we think that there, you know, was some force, maybe not a battery, with an intent, maybe, but he didn't complete it. I mean, the state was pretty consistent. I think the state essentially hedged its bets here by charging that, but they did that, and they have to live with that. And I do think. Sure, I'll agree with everyone. The request could have been more clear, but I do think it was clear enough, and I do think Judge Herndon then had an obligation
okay.
to respond.
Let me hear from the other side, and I'll, like I said, I'll give you 2 minutes in rebuttal. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Ophelia Monahan. I'm here on behalf of Respondent, the State of Nevada. First of all, I'd like to thank the court for considering the issue before the court today. I guess I'm going to dive right in with the issues with the record. I was prepared to argue all about Lisby and overturning Lisby. But I guess I would agree with Justice Pickering. The record is limited to pages 558 through 559. And I would submit that we're bound by the record. I'm at the same disadvantage as the court is today. I wasn't trial counsel. I read the entire record. And I don't think that, as Mr. Manning suggests, that it's an issue of what was naturally requested. Nor it's a matter of it being perfectly articulated. I think that instead you have to look at the plain language of the record. When I look at the record, I think that when you don't have that exact language, when you don't exactly say what it is that you're requesting, I think that now we're bound, like I said, to that record. In that regard, counsel stated that based on the testimony of Mr. Burt and Ms. Burley, the battery in this case is a force required in the robbery. Never mentioned the charge of battery with intent to commit a crime.
But counsel did say, before they mentioned the Berg and the other person's testimony, she said, I want a lesser included offense instruction. And I do struggle with how battery with intent to commit robbery is a lesser included, a true lesser included of robbery. Do you think it is? And if so, tell me how that is so.
I'm sorry, can you please repeat?
The first sentence of defense counsel, the last one, Your Honor, and you're settling instructions here on the record. The last issue we have is that we had asked for a lesser included in this case. Just take that sentence by itself and apply that to these facts. You have the argument on appeal that what she meant by that was a misdemeanor battery instruction as a lesser of battery with intent to commit robbery. Your point is when she continues and cross-references Berg and Borley and the court goes off on a sort of Jackson-Salazar thing,
correct,
what she really meant was that she thought the two charges were overlapping.
I mean, I
but my question to you is, isn't it true under a pristine lesser-included offense analysis that battery with intent to commit robbery is not a true lesser-included offense of robbery? Would you agree with me?
I know battery is a lesser-included offense of battery with intent to commit a crime, but that's not what the request was here.
No, but I'm asking you a different question.
Okay.
So let me just be clear. Is battery with intent to commit robbery a lesser-included offense of robbery?
No, because you can commit a robbery without committing a battery.
Right. So we read the record, and she says she wants a lesser-included offense instruction. If battery with intent to commit robbery is not a lesser-included of robbery, then how could her request make any sense except as a request for misdemeanor battery as a lesser-included of battery with intent to commit robbery?
I mean, I guess I am following you. And like I said, I'm at a disadvantage because I wasn't at the trial either. In my reading of the record, and I understand the
I just don't know what to do with it. I mean,
I understand the court's concern. Like I said, in my clear reading of the record, because you never specifically mention and you're never clear as to exactly what it is that you want, now we're faced here on appeal in front of the court en banc with two appellate attorneys trying to make sense of what the record is. I think that it's incumbent on the parties, as Justice Perrigary stated, to make a record. I think Judge Herndon gave the parties a chance to make a record, and that would have been counsel's opportunity to make a clear record as to exactly what it was that she wanted.
Counsel, can I ask you this on the record issue, since we're trying to divine what happened here? At the end of every time you settled your instructions, the judge asked, do you have any additional instructions to propose that he knows are not going to be approved? Did the defense ever say, yes, Judge, here's an instruction, I want a lesser included for battery, and I want this, I'm proposing this, and I know you're rejecting it, but it's part of the record. Did any of that ever happen?
That did not happen in this case.
Okay, so we're trying to guess what was going on.
That's fair.
Okay.
And there was no correction to, it was evident to me from the record that Judge Herndon, in his response, has in mind a redundancy Salazar-Jackson type analysis. And I don't see that the record says, no, Judge, you're thinking of battery with intent to commit robbery and robbery and whether those are duplicative and one or the other has to fall out, assuming the jury returns guilty verdicts on both. Nobody corrected the judge's misapprehension, if indeed.
That's correct. Nobody corrected the record. In my reading of the record, if I recall correctly, not having it in front of me, was that the parties just said okay and then went on to the next stage of the proceeding.
So the parties, the defense attorney just said, wait, Judge, we're really not talking about merger here. We're talking about the fact that I want a misdemeanor battery so that when my client's acquitted of a robbery, the client will not be convicted of a felony.
Absolutely. It's incumbent on the parties to make a record. It's your record. When it's up on appeal, like I said, it shouldn't be up to us to be here guessing, spending time, trying to figure out what it was
well,
exactly.
I guess that's our concern, too, and we try to be consistent in letting Barr know we need a record in order to make determinations. And you don't know what the reason that the record was ambiguous here. Maybe it was strategic and that ambiguity inures to the benefit of the defendant. I don't know.
Battery with intent to commit robbery is not a lesser included offense of robbery. You've conceded that.
Yes.
Fine. So if she mentions the word lesser included offense, what would it be? What's the lesser included offense?
I'm sorry.
It would be battery. Lesser included offense of battery with intent to commit robbery. It's battery.
I don't believe that that's clear within the record.
Justice Pickering hit the nail on the head. I know my colleagues may not agree, but I think she hit the nail on the head. As long as she said the word lesser-included offense, what happened is Judge Herndon got off on a tangent about merger. This was not a merger issue. Neither side was talking about merger.
That's correct, Justice Cherry. But if the merger issue would have come to light, it would have been to the benefit of the defendant. So I do believe, or Mr. Manning, so I do believe, again,
and lesser included is part of the merger analysis under Blockberger. So, it may not be quite as extreme, correct?
Correct.
So if we take the assumption that has now been set forth by both ends of the bench, that is that the only comment made, i.e. the lesser included, has to apply to the battery with intent to commit a crime, then That's where we start our analysis. Would you agree with that?
I don't agree with that, because I do believe, again, that the record should be made and that there might be strategic reasons why things may or may not
just conceded
be done.
The lesser included, and that is trial slang, if you will. You know, when we're in the midst of settling jury instructions, we frequently don't complete sentences, and that's the problem.
That's true. Okay?
But you've conceded the comment, lesser included, can't apply to battery with intent to commit a crime as to robbery, so it has to be, I mean, I think that's the default position. Can't we start with that assumption and make our decision? Because I think that's what the appellant is asking us to do here. We can set aside all the divining of what happened, but if you concede it could only apply to that count, that's where we start.
And just in all fairness, Justice, not having been part of that bench conference or the conference in the back, not having been privy to it, and not having...
I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about what we can't divine here today. I'm talking about what we do have on the record. And what we do have on the record is defense counsel coming out and asking for, slang or otherwise, a lesser included that you've just conceded cannot apply to anything other than the battery with intent to commit a crime.
That's correct.
Let me ask you this. What's the standard of review in a criminal case on an inarticulate request for an instruction? In a civil case, it seems to me this person would be dead to rights. We don't have a tendered instruction and we don't have an adequate record. But in a criminal case, defense counsel makes the point that under Crawford, there's an obligation of the district court to help with the theory of defense instructions. And clearly this guy's theory of defense was he may have knocked the guy down, but he didn't intend to take stuff from him. So we have that's their theory of defense. How does that affect what we look at in terms of our willingness to embrace an expansive view of a limited record on whether a request for a jury instruction was adequate? And does Lisby apply and shape that analysis in this case? I guess that's the question we have, following up on what Justice Sato was just saying.
Well, let me take the opposite position, because I, in essence, disagree with Justice Sato. I think that you have to make, the word was adequate record. And asking for the moon when you're only going to Las Vegas Boulevard is not the same.
Right, so
but what you're asking the court, you're asking the court to totally guess at all the possibilities. I think defense has an objection to at least get in the ballpark of what their possibility is. If they don't, then the court doesn't know if it's just a hunch that may not be appropriate, and if it's not appropriate, they won't give it to them. So the question then comes, do they have to make an adequate record? At least make a facial statement so the court could say, yes, that is a lesser, or no, it's not.
And so what's the standard? Does Crawford help us here?
In that regard, just to briefly address Justice Douglas's question, as an appellate attorney, I absolutely advocate for a clear record. The majority of what I do is appellate and habeas. So we're always constantly looking at the record. And when you have, and I understand that this case was not a very voluminous, very long trial, but when you're trying to look at a record, I think, as Justice Douglas pointed out, I think that the record should be clear exactly what it was that was wanted, because then we have errors on appeal and then looking further on post-conviction. It becomes even harder years down the line trying to guess exactly what it was that transpired that day, what the parties were seeking. In terms of
a perfect record would have included a tender, but an adequate record in this case, if the quote had been, the last one, Your Honor, the last issue we had is that we asked for a lesser included in this case, and if they had just said on misdemeanor battery, would that have been an adequate record to preserve and present this issue to us?
I believe the adequate record would have been, I'm seeking a lesser included offense of battery as to the charge of battery with intent.
Counsel, I'd like to join in this discussion. Under Crawford, we examine whether the district court's decision in settling jury instructions has resulted in abuse of discretion or judicial error. In this case, reasonable minds can differ about whether the record preserved the lesser included offense request. But one thing is clear. Lisby required an instruction on the lesser included without request. So under Lisby, this judge should have given a lesser included instruction on battery.
I don't agree with that, Justice Hardesty. If you look at the sua sponte requirement.
Excuse me?
I don't agree with that in regards to.
You don't agree that that's what Lisby says?
Oh, I do agree that that's what it says, but not that he was entitled to it, given the facts of this case and the test in Lisby.
So let's examine that.
Okay. In terms of the sua sponte.
You agree that's what Lisby says?
Yes, I do agree that there's a sua sponte.
Why did the court not commit judicial error in not giving the instruction under Lisby?
A sua sponte instruction given without a party request is required when there's evidence which would absolve the defendant from guilt of the greater offense, but would support a finding of guilt of a lesser offense. And in this case, given the testimony or the evidence that was presented to the jury, the testimony from the victim, the testimony from the independent witness, the testimony from the defendant himself, I don't believe that then what the defendant testified to in terms of this unintentional touching on a crowded bus, I might have walked kind of past rough him. I don't believe that that absolves the defendant of the greater offense.
Well, but don't you agree that there was at least enough minimal evidence under Crawford to give the theory of sought by the defense? You're saying there wasn't even minimal evidence?
I'm saying that there was minimal, but I'm saying the test under Lisby that requires evidence that absolves.
Well, wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
We say that the defense instruction is to be given if there is minimal evidence to support the theory. Lisby requires an instruction to be given without request. Haven't we said since Lisby that if it fits the defense's theory, minimal evidence, that should have been given? Regardless of this debate about whether the record is adequate or not,
there was evidence in terms of his theory of the case that he barely touched the victim, but that it was unintentional. So in that regard, when you look at the definition of battery, that requires it to be intentional, willful touching. That does not support the defense's theory of defense that he did absolutely nothing. That at worst,
but the defendant or the victim testified that he buckled his knee deliberately and shoved him down. So there was some evidence of a battery. If you put it with the defendant's testimony, he didn't intend to take anything. Isn't that some evidence that would support a battery instruction?
But
just
I think
plain vanilla battery, not fancy battery.
I'm sorry.
Plain vanilla battery.
Okay, the misdemeanor battery.
Mm-hmm.
I think that when I'm looking at the evidence as a whole, when I'm looking at exactly what it was that the defendant testified to, and when I compare that to what the victim and the independent witness testified to, I think that in my reading of the record, the defense theory in this case was that the contact itself was unintentional, was not willful, was accidental at best. So I don't believe that the defense theory was that it was a battery.
But wasn't there a backup theory that he didn't take anything and he didn't intend to take anything?
Because my reading of it, when you look at what the victim testified to and that then what the independent witness testified to, when she specifically said, I saw him go into the pocket and grab what I believed was a wallet. I don't think that there was a theory of a battery being committed. I touched him. It was willful. It was wrong. But I didn't take anything, and I didn't mean to take anything. So I don't think that that's supported. The lesser included is supported by the evidence as I read it in the record. I was going to address Lisby unless, since that was what the court did order.
Is there any Nevada case that reverses based on the failure sua sponte to instruct on the lesser included?
There is not, Justice Pickering.
And how many cases nationally actually reverse on that basis?
I am with appellant's counsel on this. I've researched this issue as exhaustively as the court, I'm sure, is aware the past month. I don't know off the top of my head. I do know that I noted at least 4 jurisdictions in my tally sheet, but it could be more than that. But it was minimal. It was
some of them in your chart show that it was not plain error to have failed to sua sponte instruct on the lesser included. And to my mind, and you had those categorized as hybrid rather than
party autonomy or trial integrity. But if you're going to credit that it's not plain error, that implicit in that may be that there was some error involved. It just didn't rise to the level of being plain. It wasn't just rejected as no error because it's pure party autonomy. So can you say that those hybrid ones, are they crediting the idea that in some cases the trial judge should, as Lisby says, give sua sponte an instruction?
And just to kind of briefly touch on that, because I understand the charts were, they were a little different, but I wasn't surprised by that because I think that, for me at least, the bright line rule in Lisby, what we're talking about today, the sua sponte duty, talks about if a court is mandated, if it's mandatory to instruct, absent a request from the parties. So that's kind of where I drew the line. And I did do different distinctions based on the amount of deference and the evidentiary threshold that the court's required to give the instruction. So in that regard, I think that when I classified a jurisdiction as hybrid, it's because it wasn't mandatory, but it was permissible. And there was some sort of review that was allowed if that instruction was given. So if I classified it as a hybrid, it was not mandatory. I only classified the trial integrity approaches as those that mandated the sua sponte jury instruction.
One more question for you, if you may. Opposing counsel indicated that the Lisby discussion was more, oh, by the way, here. Do you see it in that light? And if so, would this be an inappropriate case to discuss Lisby in our decision?
I think that I can honestly tell the court, having prepared for this hearing, having prepared for the brief, having talked to practitioners, having talked to defense counsel, having talked to prosecutors, and even given the minimal amount of authority that we have on Lisby, I think that potentially maybe the issue before the case today is whether or not a court is required, mandated to sua sponte instruct. Given the fact that Lisby was based on little to no Nevada authority, no presidential authority, it was dictum, as Justice Pickering pointed out. And I do believe that it's an appropriate issue to raise because, to be honest with you, the fact that we only have two published cases, and I believe appellant's counsel pointed out six since 1966, is this really a rule that we need? And if so, then we need clarity. I did find one unpublished order that did a plain error review on a non-requested jury instruction.
But doesn't that argue against, as a matter of stare decisis, us overturning something that is that little visited and so evidently unproblematic that it's seldom come here?
Well, I think the fact that it's being raised in this case is exactly the reason why I believe that it should be overturned.
It has to be unworkable and confusing. But
the law also can't be encased in a straitjacket, as Justice Hardesty pointed out in another opinion. I think that when we're here, and now we have this issue of, was it requested, was it not requested? Okay, so we're going to review it to see if sua sponte should have been given. And then I'm sure it'll be up for I'll have it on habeas, ineffective assistance of counsel. Is this rule really necessary? Are the parties using it? Is this something that should be left up to the parties? And just to briefly, am I out of time?
Yep.
Okay.
Well, the problem with habeas in this case is that under Lisby, if this was a sua sponte instruction requirement of the judge, then I'm not sure there is an ineffective assistance of counsel.
That's correct. I was more touching upon whether it was requested or not.
Right.
And if it was sua sponte, then...
Well, whether she requested it or not. Under Lisby, if the court was duty-bound sua sponte to give the instruction, then maybe there's no ineffective assistance of counsel in the case.
Perhaps not.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Well, I was just going to say, if they're duty-bound, then there's no ineffective assistance of counsel because it's going to be reversed.
Well, that's correct, but I was more speaking if it was requested. Thank you for your time, Justice.
Thank you. Okay, 2 minutes.
Just picking up right where we left off. Maybe I said it in an artful way, Your Honor. I didn't necessarily mean that the Lisby issue was unimportant when I did that.
Okay.
I do think it's important. And picking up on ineffective assistance, here's where it would be ineffective assistance of counsel. If I got this appeal, and there's that Lisby issue staring at me in the face, and I ignore it, and this court doesn't reverse because I didn't raise the issue, and then Mr. Manning goes on PCR and says, why in the world did my appellate attorney not raise such an obvious issue that the judge had this obligation to respond to raise it? So I did not mean to suggest that it's unimportant. I just meant to suggest that the thrust of my argument in direct appeal was that she asked for it. Now, again, we can all debate that, and you know, it's an interesting discussion. But then I also noticed Lisby, which, again, has seldom been applied, which I do agree with Judge Justice Pickering, which sort of suggests that it's not unworkable, it's not problematic, it's not inconsistent with, you know, changes in the law and so forth. And if you, I think I was the one who pointed out in the chart that I made that of the party autonomy jurisdiction, there was a number that applied plain error, which I thought meant that you could probably more put them in the hybrid category. Because you're right, if a judge has no obligation whatsoever and you raise on appeal in one of these jurisdictions, well, why didn't the judge sua sponte instruct? At that point, the appellate court should say, but it's not required, so we're just ignoring this issue. It's a non-issue. We're not even discussing it. Why even apply plain error? It's not error at all, plain or otherwise. So I think when you consider that, now you've got the vast majority of jurisdictions that either require it, as Lisby does, or gives the judge some discretion. And so this idea that, well, you know, I mean, the state takes a position, respondent takes a position that we should just join the party autonomy approach, and it's great. And, I mean, look, if you see me outside in 15 minutes, I'll probably tell you, like, yeah, there's some benefits to it, I suppose, but that's not really the issue here. The issue is it unworkable? Have intervening developments in the law rendered it useless? And no, that's not true. And most states don't think so either. I think that's all my time. If there isn't any other questions, then.
Colleagues?
I'll spare them.
All right. Well, thank you both very much. It's a very interesting issue. You did a very good job presenting it. We appreciate it. You know what kind of work you put into our supplemental requests, and we very much appreciate it. So.